Harrison Green and his two partners have founded Propagate Ag to further integrate sustainability into agricultural land. And their process is to make trees and agroforestry a cornerstone. And the reasons for doing this, well, they just prove themselves more and more every growing season. Harrison is here to share all for Cultivated Audio, July 2026. I'm Robin. Grab your earbuds and or a shovel and let's dig in. So, Harry, what was your mission when you and your buddies founded Propagate Ag?
We formally incorporated in 2017, so it's been almost 10 years now. And our mission has always been to cement agroforestry as a cornerstone of agriculture and normalize or renormalize trees on farms. And when I say trees on farms, it's usually trees on farms on purpose. That means things like we focus on chestnut orchards. We do a lot of fast-growing timber trees, black locust, hybrid poplar. And we look at trees not only for their ecosystem benefits, say water quality, flood mitigation, biodiversity, et cetera, but for their economic benefits. Long-term trees can yield maybe double the internal rate of return or a lot more revenue per acre than a good number of row crops like corn, soy. And farmers are always looking for options. So we have this suite of tree crops for farms, mostly in the eastern United States, that we offer. And that's the scoop.
All right. Well, I know that in Europe, a few years back, I spoke with a man from Portugal, Alfredo Sendien, and he was working a lot in agroforestry, growing a lot of trees for acorns. And that's a food base that was forever used so much in Portugal, and then it went out of favor, so to speak. And now it's coming back. So are you finding that agroforestry is growing in the U.S. as much as in Europe? I know obviously you all are helping move this along, but just hearing you say it can be more profitable is kind of a surprise to row crops, yeah. Right?
Agroforestry is often a niche practice in that there aren't a lot of farmers that will use the word agroforestry. But if you look at people, if you look at what people are doing, in addition to what words they're using to describe a practice, then you often find that there are a lot more acres in agroforestry than one would initially believe. You alluded to or just mentioned acorns in Portugal, the Dehesa or the Montado over that
yes.
way. And that was, it's the cork oaks with pigs eating the acorns. Often folks will eat the acorn flour as well. And you're thinking about trees producing food. And you're also thinking about the number of meals that an acre or a hectare can yield. And that's not just food and number of people fed, but it's the number of people fed while sustaining an ecosystem. So say corn, if you look at the number of calories per acre it produces, say 13 to 15 million calories per acre. Chestnuts, on the other hand, might produce, they produce fewer calories per acre, between 2 and 3 million calories per acre. But most corn doesn't actually go to feed people. It goes to ethanol, some goes directly to livestock, and then what's left over from making ethanol to go in cars goes to feed livestock. And I think it's about 2% of corn goes to feed people directly. And if you feed that corn to livestock, say chickens, for example, you actually get back down to about 2 to 3 million calories per acre when you grow corn. So we want to look at not just the quantity of food that we're producing on an acre, but also the quality of food, whether that's micronutrient density, protein, complete amino acids, vitamins and minerals per unit, fat, carbs, protein, et cetera. Agroforestry is a way of holistically looking at farmland, at least where it rains and or snows. Yeah, happy to dive in anywhere that makes sense from there.
Sure. And the economy, of course, is at the forefront of every farmer's mind. So you just represented one piece of that. I'm wondering, do the farmers get that if someone has an established farm and they decide, well, is agroforestry going to be good for us? Because they're going to lose some cropland, which means losing a few years. But just the biodiversity factor is something that needs to be calculated in that mix.
It's a good point. It's a good question. And there's a lot there. So biodiversity doesn't replace income for farmers. It can complement it. Let's unpack a few assumptions that are common when we're thinking about farmers planting trees. First one is, if we think about technology adoption or the adoption of a new practice, there are going to be innovators that adopt it very soon. There's going to be an early majority that adopts it after them. There's going to be a late majority that adopts it, say, after the average person adopts it. And then there are going to be laggards, which are folks that are not really interested in new things. And when we think about farmers planting trees, we often think about a 68-year-old grain farmer in Iowa planting trees on flat, perfect corn ground that is infinitely optimized for growing grain. And you could have that be the scenario, but more often agroforestry is not reserved for more subprime farmland, but it's a better fit for land that doesn't have as high of an opportunity cost. So every farmer has, say, that one bad acre. And sometimes trees can be a good fit for that land. That being said, if you're looking at a crop that, yes, well, you do have to wait a few years because it's a tree, it doesn't yield in year one. But once you get to yields and break even, the revenue per acre just vastly eclipses grain. It's obviously not on all trees. It's on this subset of trees. So we shouldn't think about agroforestry as a replacement for grain all the time. In some cases it can be, but also as a but more of a complement for the innovative farmers at this point in time. There are other regions of the world where agroforestry is much more common. There are 200,000 acres of silvopasture intentionally planted in the north of Argentina. You had also asked about taking land out of production. And production is really important to define. So we have food production, and then we have the economic production. So first is calories, and then you have capital or currency, 3 C's. And then the third C, you could think about carbon as a proxy for ecosystem services, because yeah, the land does a lot more for us than just feed us and keep our lights on. So in terms of production, agroforestry, from a caloric perspective, I kind of laid that out before. So it's not necessarily, you're not going to feed more people per acre with it, but you are going to feed more people per unit of ecologically intact, reasonable farmland. And then honestly, any business, agriculture specifically, the more you value add and focus on marketing, the more margin you're going to capture. So agroforestry, but tree crops in general, vertically integrated, are usually much more profitable than annual grains.
Now, you mentioned the bad acre that someone has. Let's roll with that for a second, because it's true, everyone's property, there is an area that's just not producing as much. What do you look at when you go in and say, okay, well, let's take this acreage here and plant trees? Do you have to work with the soil? What do you look for in soil? Is it any different than if you're going to do some grain production or some other kind of fruit or vegetable? And can you plant trees right away and then improve the soil as you go? What does that look like?
That's a really good question. So I'd say there are two questions there. First is, yes, what do we look for? And second is, how do we improve the soil? First off, subprime ag land can be subprime or suboptimal or subproductive for a number of reasons. Three that we see often are land that's too dry, land that's too wet, and soil that's not deep enough. And soil that's not deep enough, say you have a very minimal depth to bedrock or depth to a water table that's not going to go down, that's a hard one to solve. There are a lot of drainage techniques, so there's ditches or tile that you can put in. For wet soil, there are also tree crops, trees that are adapted to wet soil. That's a huge question where I am up in upstate New York. And then soil that's too dry, you can add irrigation, you can increase organic matter, water holding capacity of the soil, and that would lead to the second part of the question, which is, how do you improve soil? And you can go into corn ground or pasture and plant trees, but your success rate, especially if you're just planting in pasture, and the growth rate of those trees is going to be drastically reduced. Grass and trees don't necessarily complement each other in year one when those trees are starting off. So what you want to do, say if you're going into grassland, you don't need a huge strip. If you're going into pasture, grassland's different. We're not thinking about the Great Plains here. You want to minimize that grass competition. And what we do there is flail mow it all down, make sure all that thatch is decomposed. And then we subsoil it to break up any hard pan that's there, sometimes disc it, rototill it, and then possibly seed it with a cover crop 12 to 18 months ahead of time. It can be 6 months ahead of time as well. But ideally, you're bringing that soil to a place where those trees are just going to take off. And good soil prep ahead of time pays for itself significantly. Even if you're waiting 12 months, you're going to make up that time if you do good soil prep.
The savvy farmer, and especially the regenerative farmers, probably can follow you down that path pretty easily about knowing, okay, I'm just going to let this be. They let their fields lie fallow so it can regenerate biological growth, etc. Are you finding that farmers in general will get that, or is that more of a thing that regenerative farmers get?
So with letting fields lay fallow in order to reestablish productivity, if we think about, say, conventional or organic crop rotation between hay and pasture grazed with livestock, small grains, and then, say, corn and soy, what letting a field lie fallow would usually do is just kind of let the soil recuperate a little bit, let it grow up, have the organic matter increase, and then plow it again and seed it. And if you look at how most organic farmers with a good rotation do that, is they actually incorporate livestock. So after they grow corn, which needs a lot of nitrogen, they'll seed pasture, and then they'll graze it for a few years. And the good ones will use management intensive rotational grazing or AMP grazing, adaptive multi-paddock grazing, which is where you're using livestock, usually cattle, to mimic what a herd of wild herbivores would do, turning grass into soil through their digestive system, basically turning hay and grass into compost, and then increasing the amount of carbon and fertility in the soil. So if you think about using photosynthesis like that to create organic fertility, I would, to your question, the regenerative farmers are going to be more attuned to that. But there are also conventional farmers that aren't necessarily organic that follow a lot of those principles and practices.
Yes, the experienced ones for sure, I would say. Describe ecological succession, what your view of that is, and how do you work with that when you are going into a new property and they say, okay, let's go for this so we can have a good biodiverse property?
Ecological succession is going to look really different depending on which part of the country you're on. I'll reference it a little bit for the Great Plains. I believe you are out in Boulder. and then I'll move east from there. If we look at the climax ecosystem in the dry grasslands, maybe moving into the humid tall grass prairies, the biggest plants you're going to get there, or the most complete ecosystem, is that of grasses, herbaceous plants with either livestock or wild grazing animals, say bison. And it used to be a much more diverse array of megafauna 12,000 plus years ago. In dry places, drier places, you're looking to reestablish that flywheel of herbaceous plants and animals, because the only place that those nutrients, that dry plant matter, will break down is in the gut of an animal. And as you move farther east in the United States, in North America, you see more forests. It goes from dry grassland to humid prairies to savanna to closed canopy forest. I'm in upstate New York, so we're in closed canopy forest. And if you let a cornfield just go, or a pasture just go, you didn't do anything to it, you would have different tree species move in, colonize that field over a certain amount of time. First, you'd usually have the wind-pollinated species. So you'd have cottonwoods, white pines often. You'd have bird-pollinated species, so species that where birds drop berries, the seed germinates, grows up in the field. Then you'd have bigger seeds, so things like acorns, chestnuts, walnuts, hickories, that are distributed by rodents and other animals. And those larger seeded trees are often representative of the climax ecosystem, the highest expression of the ecosystem in the forest biomes. And if you want to accelerate that 30-year process of getting from grass to oak trees or grass to chestnuts, you can introduce and plant and manage all different types of trees. You can interplant, say, willows, cottonwoods, early successional species, or black locust, alder, with these, say, mid and late successional species. These fast-growing early successional pioneer trees, they'll bring the forest fungi, usually call it just forest-based fungi because that's the easiest way to understand it, but ectomycorrhizae into the pasture, because they associate with both the pasture fungi, endomycorrhizae, and forest fungi. And they'll gradually make that soil more fungal dominant,
right,
and pave the way for those longer-term nut trees. That's really a reforestation scheme standpoint. If you want to manage that and derive income, you can simply select the early and later successional species that create income for farmers. And as you are reestablishing a forest or an agroforestry system, it's a diffuse boundary between the two, it's not black and white, you can make money along the way.
Right. And by having those early growth trees, you can bring in pigs, come to mind for me, and I don't know, so you can help me share information here, of course, but it seems like they're a great animal to root around in an early growth forest. They, in turn, will, of course, with their manure and everything else and digging around, it's all such a brilliant system. So do you recommend there's a certain time before you would introduce animals, and would pigs be the call? Would they be the main one or the best one initially?
That's a really good question. So as with trees, there are obviously different types of animals that are suited to different disturbance regimes. If you just plant trees and then put pigs right in there, pigs will pretty much just delete the trees. Easiest type of animal, or the best fit type of animal, livestock, to put into a recently planted agroforestry system is probably ducks, because ducks and geese, they eat herbaceous plants, grass, and they turn it into fertility. And then they don't dig up the trees. One level up is chickens. More people eat chicken eggs and chicken than they do duck eggs and duck. That's a little bit easier to sell and market that livestock. They scratch around, they eat the bugs. They also turn the grass to a certain extent into manure, into fertility. Once the trees are, say, large broom handle to baseball bat width, you're looking at incorporating sheep. So you don't want the sheep to chew the bark off the trees, but if the sheep can turn the grass into fertility for the trees, that's a great scenario. With pigs, let's see, if you had a field of invasive shrubs and you wanted to have a diversity of livestock deleting those shrubs, the pigs would root around. Goats could eat the shrubs down. Pigs can be, if you really like pigs, totally cool. They can be pretty hard on the land. That can be good if you want disturbance. But you just want to be really careful when incorporating pigs. You can wring their noses so they don't root around as much.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
And then a larger type of livestock, cattle, once those trees are big enough to not be damaged, if they are a scratching post, then, yeah, cattle can come in and do the same thing as sheep.
Yes, I guess I thought of the pigs because I was speaking to someone one time, and I think that's what they were talking about, was that low-level bush that was kind of invasive, and having the pigs there for that was really a good idea. I know, obviously, pigs, gosh, on the Hawaiian Islands, they just wreak havoc. People that drive around with 10 to 12 dogs in the back of their pickup, and they'll go in the evenings, and the dogs will run around and exhaust the pigs, and then the owner of the dogs will take care of the pigs, and then the farmers are happy again after they get the pigs off from eating every single thing in sight.
They have to put up hog fencing out there.
Yeah,
we have to put up deer
razor
fencing.
Sharp. Not a good scenario for the farmers over there. Harry, it seems to me that it would be tricky in a sense to go to an area where you aren't familiar with the land necessarily, and specifically that land that you're going to help this person with. And yet there is such a universality of growing plants. What factors come into focus for you in making planting decisions? And maybe just share an example of a property you've worked with.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Something that is either what we can say common or universal across cultures and across regions is you have to look at the people managing the land before you prescribe or recommend what trees would be a good fit. People who are interested in trees on the whole are generally open-minded. They're interested in nature. How they differ is how many hours they want to add to their plate and how many people they want to work with and manage. So those differences are really measurements of, we can say, agreeableness and extroversion. And then the question of, is the person interested in things, so equipment, technology, tractors, or to what extent are they interested in people, marketing, value add, and all of those, say, interpersonal dynamics that are required for a farm to be successful long-term. So you want to look at, how someone wants to manage their land and their life, and you want to be open-minded, and you want to ask good follow-up questions. You referenced Hawaii, so I'll give you an example there. We worked with the Hawaii Ulu Cooperative. They grow breadfruit and a large number of canoe crop carbohydrates, different starches, staple crops that made their way across the Pacific in canoes with the Polynesians. And I had never been to Hawaii before. I grew up in Massachusetts. I now live and farm in New York State. I went to undergrad in Vermont and with grad school. I've lived other places, Colorado, Argentina, Spain. But when you go to a new place, the questions that you want to ask are often very similar. You want to ask what people want. That can be open-ended or specific. And then when you're looking at a new tree crop or a tree crop that you're already familiar with, you could we'll take the tropical crops for this instance. We looked at breadfruit, coffee, cacao, squash, mamaki, which is a type of tea, yes, sugarcane, banana, and a few others. And the questions you ask to do the economic modeling there are, what are all of the tasks that it takes to bring this crop to break even, to plant it, to manage it, to harvest it, to market it, processing, all of that? What are the inputs? How long does it take to do each one? And then from there, that's basically managerial accounting, and you can generate a financial model. When you go into a new place, what we do, because you specifically asked about new places, you're doing the job of not just a kind of a social scientist or a socially inclined person of being open-minded, but you're also being not a bookkeeper, but you're doing this economic modeling work to see how these new trees will financially and socially and culturally fit with a place.
Yes, and I'm sure you have quite a form, or I would assume you do, of questions for the people, so you can really cut to the chase on that kind of information. Not that you want to make it short or not an important piece of what goes on, but just so you can immediately get some kind of idea and then proceed from there.
Yeah, and the more homework you do beforehand, the better. The internet is a phenomenal thing. There are books on all sorts of tree crops. Video media is really important just to see how things work. And if you're just on this line of thought of new crops and new practices in new places, you want to go and read the book and the PDFs and understand and know what questions to ask. Because the more specific follow-up questions you can ask, then the more people will open up when you're co-creating this financial model.
Yes.
And we've done that. I think we've modeled over 100 different crops across many different geographies, from the Mediterranean crops to the tropics to the temperate climates where we operate here. And there you have these traditional crops like blueberries and apples, and often those are really difficult to farm because they're fully commoditized. It's hard to create a unique product because everyone has been growing apples for 200 years, and we've figured that out. So often agroforestry has a lot to do with these new crops. Every so often we'll model a new crop for the cold climates, but a lot of the work now is introducing these crops to people. And we're not doing the R&D work so much anymore as just marketing what chestnuts end up looking like economically, procedurally, in a management sense.
Right, sure.
Everything from that to elderberries to black locust fence posts. Growing your own fence posts is a big one. To trees for water quality if we're working with NGOs or government agencies. We have a broad business, and it's a lot of fun.
Right. Do you ever work with any luthiers?
Oh, for guitars. I had a friend who was a luthier in Colorado. Not yet. My business partner, Jeremy, and Ethan as well, are very musically oriented. Jeremy's a phenomenal guitar player. I'm sure he would love to make, or he probably knows someone.
Right. It would be so fun to create
a
musical forest.
Or at least has, you know, actually, you know what? We just did a podcast with Rowan Reed in Australia, who grows his own trees for timber, for lumber. And yeah, they go to guitars. So very exciting.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. Wood is so beautiful. Before we move on, going back into questions, is there a common question or two that people ask you when they're starting to think about all of this?
There are many, definitely. I think something that we haven't touched on is farm succession. We talked about ecological succession, but often you have, say, a matriarch, patriarch, who are looking at retiring. Maybe they're well into retirement. They have their kids. Maybe there's a third generation. The average age of the American farmer, I believe, is 58 or 59. That's average on the older side of things. And you want to look at how a farm can either stay in the family or at least keep being profitable or increase in profitability. This is true across regen ag, conventional ag, organic.
Of course.
Name your adjective.
Yes.
So I think people are interested in not just planting trees, but the things that go along with trees. So creating a legacy, and trees are a really good way to do that.
Yeah, I know my dad planted some black walnut for the wood on his apple orchard or in his apple orchards. So he was looking into the future for that one, I think.
Yeah, it's a long-term tree. Those are good.
So talking about landscapes and trees here in the U.S., we have the eastern area, and then we have the Great Plains, and then we have the West Coast. Is there a tree that you can plant more universally geographically than others that you work with? Or talk about trees a little bit. You've mentioned the chestnut and a few others, but tell us what trees you like working with and why.
Yeah, that's a good question. So can you plant, is there a tree that grows everywhere? And what trees do we like working with? Trees that grow in a lot of different places. There are many varieties of willow, and there are still many, but fewer varieties of poplar or cottonwood aspen, popple in the populus genus. And those trees usually grow in wet areas. And if you look at their distribution across North America, it's not totally ubiquitous. It's almost ubiquitous. So that's a tree that grows everywhere, and then everyone usually knows. The Alamo in Texas. Alamo is poplar or cottonwood in Spanish. And then those trees grow up to Vermont, Maine, northern, up basically aspens grow to where deciduous trees really no longer do grow, all the way far north. So huge range there. And then trees that we like working with, we still like trees that grow quickly. We like the long-term stuff, and at least in the American mind, instant or quick gratification is really nice. So black locust grows quickly for rot-resistant fence posts and lumber. The lumber there can sell for as much as black walnut, but you get a saw log in one half to a third of the time. We have a clone of hybrid poplar that has a figured grain. So for wet locations like the cottonwood, that kind of upgrades that wood from really entry-level wood to something that's a lot nicer, like hard maple, price equivalent. And then chestnuts, big fan there. We've planted about 1,500 acres. We manage a good number of acres of chestnuts in Kentucky, Ohio, Tennessee, and New York. Those, because they do grow relatively quickly if the soil is good for chestnuts. And they produce these good tasting staple crops to be eaten fresh, roasted, in flour, in baked goods. It's a starch that breaks down slowly, so it almost feels like you're eating protein. And then on my farm in Trumansburg, New York, I have a lot of chestnuts, a lot of locust, a lot of hickory. So bitternut hickory or yellow bud hickory. You can press the nut in the shell for oil. It's in the pecan family. And all the tannins that make the nut bitter just stay behind in the nut meat, and the oil is a phenomenal culinary oil. I had a lot of that planted along with persimmons. And then inside my deer fence, it's only on 1 acre, so it's very much a hobby. I have 20 different types of fruit.
Amazing. Let me ask you about the chestnut. Did I read somewhere that you all aren't really a fan of the American chestnut and you use others?
We love the American chestnut. And the American chestnut is almost this millennium cathedral of restoration, in that what it looks like is true is that it's going to take a very long time for the American chestnut to come back in full force. I am optimistic that there will be accelerations there. And while you're building that cathedral, you want a house to live in at the same time. So we plant Chinese chestnuts and Chinese American hybrid chestnuts. And Chinese chestnuts, they're a shorter tree. So they're almost like between a full-sized apple and a very small oak tree. They produce high-quality orchard nuts for production. So folks really like to eat those. The taste is functionally the same as the American chestnut. They're not a large forest tree. So they're an orchard chestnut as opposed to a forest chestnut. And they've been bred, as far as we know, for a lot longer. So the genetics are a bit more consistent in terms of a food crop.
So what is the difference then, a forest chestnut?
So an orchard chestnut, it's just it's a smaller tree.
Smaller,
it'll be
okay.
A bit more, I could say more manageable, but I would just juxtapose it with an American chestnut is going to be a lot taller. And it's going to grow up into an absolutely massive tree.
Right.
And yeah, it's just different. The biggest cultivated trees that you'll see are pecans, I would say. I'm happy to be corrected there, but at least in the U.S., pecans, depending where you are, can get very large. And American chestnuts would be even larger.
Boy, pecan trees, just as a side note, have, in Texas anyway, have the grossest looking worms I've ever seen in my life.
On the nut or on the tree?
In the nut. When you open a pecan,
you got to manage all that. There are weevils in all sorts of nuts. So, yeah, pest management is a big part of farming.
Right.
Because if you're a pig or a deer or a caveman, you don't mind the worms. It's just more protein.
Right.
But this day and age, you got to have clean food.
Definitely not a caveman. So there is such a resurgence. I'm sure you're on the front line of that, of homesteaders, which usually means like a lot of 2 to 5 acre-ish size properties. What tip or two would you give to someone? How many trees would you plant as far as acreage on that, like a quarter of an acre or disperse all throughout?
Yeah. 2 to 5 acre homestead. I would, in terms of food, trees, look at what you like eating. Because you want to try all the fruit. You want to eat it before you go and plant it. You don't want to wait 5 years to find out that you just spent a lot of time and money and energy tending a tree that someone else will like to eat more than you do. Small farms can be really phenomenal. So for anyone that's looking at buying 50 acres or more, or people like round numbers and we have 10 fingers. So people say, I want 100 acres. You probably don't want 100 acres unless you are really into cattle. So small farms can do a lot. So you want to look at what you want to eat, and then you want to look at what you want to be managing. You want to look at when you have that family reunion every year, because if that's at the same time as, say, the black currants or elderberries are coming online, then that's going to be a conversation with the family.
That's a question from an experienced person. You've just more than qualified yourself, Harry.
Yeah. So, yeah, example, my family runs a summer camp. And do you want to have fruit or a type of tree that complements the camp, or is a drain on the experience, or makes you busy in May when you're really busy getting ready for the high summer? Other things that you can look at are livestock. On a homestead perspective, I'm a big fan of chickens and ducks. I've had multiple rounds of chickens and ducks in my life. Kids can manage chickens and ducks. They're not dangerous. Yeah. Sheep are decent. If you have a lot of grass that you want to turn into meat, you can get lambs in the spring and graduate them to freezer camp in the fall. So you don't have to overwinter livestock if you don't want to be carrying hay around. But if you do want to be carrying hay around and feeding livestock in the winter, it's totally cool. Yeah, you just want to look at your lifestyle. If you are farming for a lifestyle, which is what generally homesteading is.
Perfect. Yes. Well, Harry, usually I start with this, but let's finish with this for you today and have you tell us a little bit more about your property. You mentioned you have so many fruit trees, and maybe zero in and tell us a few more things about your property.
Of course. Yeah. So I bought this farm in 2021. I moved to the Ithaca-Trumansburg area to buy a farm. The soil here is generally very good. I was in Vermont, and I love Vermont dearly, and there's a lot of clay there. And if you're not in clay, you're usually far away from people. And I'm 98th percentile extroversion, so I do like people a whole lot. Socializing and all that gives me good energy. Mm. And so I'm 11 minutes north of town, and I'm on 50 acres, which if you think about farmland near a population center, what I just described is not necessarily very common. So Ithaca is a phenomenal place. My farm specifically has a creek running through it. It hasn't gone dry in the multiple decades that the neighbors have been here. So water is plentiful. It's probably 50 feet of elevation difference from the bottom to the top. There's some well-drained soil. There's some poorly drained soil. The one thing I don't have is an amazing pond spot. I have a few B-grade pond spots that I may dig a pond in the future. For now, I have a stock tank. I have a barn where I am talking to you from right now. It's a 24 by 36 foot round pole timber framed barn with an office on the second floor.
Nice.
Heated with a wood stove. My friend Courtney leases an acre and grows vegetables. So she's a salad farmer and a flower farmer, which is very exciting because I like eating vegetables and I always need to eat more of them. And let's see, there's a campsite in the woods that I rent out on Hip Camp and use for fun events as well. My friend Sheila, for her master's in fine arts thesis or final project, did a project on maple sap. It's a mix of art and maple, which I'll leave to your imagination. It was very good. And then we have events here. In May this year, we had the first ever third annual Birding Man Festival. So it was a one-day festival of music, let's call it music, agroecology, and art. We had a forester, Ethan Tapper, come in, talk about forestry for birds. We had 10 different workshops. Everything from shiitakes to local food throughout the year to music. We had a food forest art show, which was very good. I had probably 30 artists come in. We had two bands and a DJ, and we had a big bird effigy made of scrap wood that lit up the night sky. So this is it's a fun place to be.
Many thanks to Harrison Green, and I'd like to throw in that considering the summer we're having, there's nothing like sitting under the shade of a nice tree and listening to the wind moving through the leaves. For anything we do here, it's cultivatedaudio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make Here, Where We All Want to Be.